Comrades, Marx wrote, the history of all hitherto existing societies is a history of class struggles. Class struggles. National struggles. For Marxists, the starting point of any analysis of a concrete political phenomena has to start with the question of what are the class interests involved. And therefore, when we say what is our attitude to national struggles, the first thing we have to say is what is the class content? And that class content is not all we have to say, as I'll do in a moment or two, but that has to be our starting point. And as soon as we take that as our starting point, something else follows. They are not all the same. I'll illustrate this by looking at East European nationalism in the first half of the last century. That sounds rather recondite. No, it's because Marx and Engels wrote about it, and I want to develop their ideas, and indeed to defend their ideas against many critics who think they are Marxists. You see, if we look, the year is now 1847, right? We look at national movements in the Europe of the time is dominated, Central and Eastern Europe, dominated by three big reactionary powers. The most important one, the Tsarist Empire, which at that time was militarily and in every other way the dominant power in Eastern Europe. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, a vast conglomeration of territories stitched together at various times with many different ethnic groups and so on, and Prussia, the rest of Germany, divided still into a number of states. Okay? Now then, for Marx and Engels, 1847 was the year the Communist Manifesto was written. Right, you know, okay, all hitherto existing societies, class struggles. For Marx and Engels, you look at Polish nationalism. What is its class? Polish nationalism was real. There was an insurrection in 1846, the year before, right? It was a real and important thing. You ask, what is its class context? Well, unquestionably, any nationalist movement seeks to unite all classes under the dominance of the one that is seeking hegemony, right, in the fall of the nation, etc., etc. What's actual class content, the leadership of Polish nationalism, not the bourgeoisie, which didn't really exist at that time on any scale, and insofar as it did, wasn't Polish. Not the petty bourgeoisie, right, not the mass of the peasantry, or the urban petty bourgeoisie. The backbone of Polish nationalism was the gentry. Right, that is to say, the smaller landowners. This is the heart and core of it. The Polish nation, in quotes, the whole notion of a nation, really rested on that layer, in this case. Are these people socially progressive? No, they are socially reactionary. Okay? Polish nationalism. Now we look at the embryonic Czech nationalism. What is now Czechoslovakia was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, as was a slice of Poland. What is the class basis at that time of Czech nationalism? It is quite different. It is the educated or semi-educated urban Czech-speaking bourgeoisie, right? A petty bourgeoisie, I mean. Urban Czech-speaking. What is the thrust of Czech nationalism? Polish nationalism is simple. First against Russia, but also against Prussia. Against Austria, because Poland is partitioned, you know, between all of them. Czech nationalism, it is above all anti-German. The basis of the thing, see, is the development, urban society, bureaucracy, jobs. Jobs are very, very important in terms of nationalist movements, in particular, in terms of urban petty bourgeoisie, who gets the jobs, who is at an advantage, who is at a disadvantage. Now then, come 1848-49, I'll lump them together, I haven't time to go through the course of events, there was, following the French February Revolution, a series of upheavals staggered over the period, which wrecked temporarily the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which temporarily paralysed the Prussian state, which led to the setting up of what was to be the German Federal Parliament, the Frankfurt Talking Shop, as Marx called it, you know, which is going to transform Germany and all the rest of it. What this, in essence, a bourgeois revolution. Okay? directed against all the relics of quasi-feudal and reactionary absolutist relics and so on and so forth. Marx and Engels, of course, were 100% in favour of this. Now, that's the central thing, right? The French February was not a bourgeois revolution. The French bourgeois revolution was in the past, yeah? It was a change of regime within the framework of what was already, in fact, a thoroughly bourgeois society. That wasn't true of Central and Eastern Europe. Marx and Engels took the following attitude. In Eastern Europe, the struggle against Tsarism, against the Austrian Empire, against Prussia, assumes commonly a national, in quotes, form. Now, I've said, we look at it in class terms. I haven't time to go through the whole bloody lot, but we stick with the Poles and the Czechs. What is our attitude to Polish and Czech nationalism? Absolutely for the Polish movement, which is led by people who are socially reactionary. How on earth can you come to this position? Because the perspective is not a perspective of Poland simply, it is a European perspective. It is an international perspective. Anything which effectively weakens Tsarism, right, fundamentally important for the success of the bourgeois revolution in Germany, etc. Therefore, we are for Polish nationalism, Czech nationalism. Now, you can make a case in terms of formal categories. This is socially more progressive, isn't it? And yet Marx and Engels were resolutely opposed to the Czech national movement at this time. Indeed, someone who is a Marxist, he's dead now, a Marxist, but also, I'm sorry to say, a bit of a Ukrainian nationalist, has written that he's gone through all the writings of Marx and Engels on the question and showed, you know, it's very inconsistent. They don't apply the class criteria consistently and so on and so forth. Okay? In fact, you see, that's true if you think in terms of formal criteria. But if you ask yourself, what was the important thing in 1848? It was the overthrow of the old regimes, the establishment of bourgeois republics. For this, Tsarism has to be broken. For this, the Austrian Empire has to be ripped into pieces. For this, Germany has to be unified. Therefore, you apply, right? First of all, you have no illusions about the class content. The revolution is a bourgeois revolution in Germany, so on and so forth. Without any illusions in its class content, you ask, in terms of the international perspective, what is the best outlook, the best prospect for us? What do we fight for? And you determine your attitude to all other movements in the light of those of that central theme. Now, all right, you can say, but come on. That's a long time ago. What happened subsequently? Well, I haven't time to talk about everything that happened subsequently. I will now take two stages in the development of Lenin's attitude, because Lenin, of course, was and had to be very much concerned with the national question. The old Tsarist Empire still survived, you know, 1848, 49 failed at the end of the day. The old regimes moulded on or were internally transformed in the German case. Two stages. First of all, there was the argument with Rosa Luxemburg about Poland. Now, this is often not treated very thoroughly. That is to say, people say, yeah, Lenin was right, Luxemburg is wrong, national self-determination, Bob's your uncle, that's the end of the story. It's not quite like that. You see, the argument was this. The Luxemburg and others, but we'll take her as the name to stand for them, argued, look here, Polish nationalism is now reactionary. They agreed, of course, with the attitude Marx and Engels had had in 1848-49, is that it is now reactionary. Why? A number of arguments. One, economic integration, right? The fragmentation into a number of small states, etc., is not in the interests of the working class. The Polish bourgeoisie, they argued, actually is not, you know, capitalism is now developing in the country. It's not now in any serious sense a progressive class around whose interests the development of a national movement can serve our interests. Therefore, but the petty bourgeoisie, right, now a different kind of petty bourgeoisie in Poland, petty-bourgeois nationalism is the enemy. Is the enemy, because this is what we contend with in trying to win workers to a revolutionary, internationalist, Marxist position. Therefore, we reject Polish nationalism, we reject the slogan of independence for Poland outright. Right? We reject it totally. What was Lenin's position? First of all, he agreed that for Polish, he put it, for Polish social democrats, using that, that was the term then used by Marxists to describe themselves, it is right to put the emphasis on hostility to Polish nationalism, on hostility to the right wing of the Polish Socialist Party, which was in reality a petty bourgeois nationalist thing. It is right for Poles, right? It is not right for Russians, for the following reasons. One, this empire, this conglomerate with umpteen different groups compressed together, forced together, attempts made to Russify them and so on, it is inconceivable that you can transform this, that there can be a revolution which does not involve the initial breakup. Right? We are for unity. We are for unity of peoples and so on, but the initial breakup is essential. And that, moreover, you have got to ask yourself, where are we standing? I repeat, if you're a Pole, you expose the reactionary nature of the petty bourgeois nationalist ideology. You attack it all the time. They are your practical opponents, right? In the immediate sense. For a Russian, the emphasis has to be exactly the other way round. Because it is great Russian nationalism, the official ideology of the regime, that is for us the central thing. And therefore, you have got to insist that we stand for, without any compromise at all, the right of self-determination, not only for the Poles, but for all the nationalities pulled together in what Lenin called this great prison house of peoples. Up to and including, he said, the right to secession. Let us be clear, he does not advocate secession, right? On the contrary, accepts the argument. Economically, it is reactionary. It is a nonsense. But you have to accept the right of secession precisely in order to fight the influence of the reactionary petty bourgeois nationalists. You see, we say, do we support a national movement? Come on. In some ways, it's analogous to the circumstances in which you are compelled to support a labourish party. It's a two-sided thing. All the time, the support is also a way in which you fight their ideas. Now, that was as far as Lenin got by 1930. That's the Lenin of, if I can find it, if I can't, this lovely little pamphlet called Critical Notes on the National Question. If you read it carefully, you will find that there is practically nothing in it along the lines of what people think Lenin's position on the national question in general is. Why not? Because, repeat yet again, analysis has always got to be concrete. Lenin, in that period, 14, 15, so on, developed his ideas, other people were doing it too, and a change in the nature of capitalism international, as he backdated to around the turn of the century. And that is, you know, the well-known imperialism thesis. And so, we've got a generalization of views on his views on the national question, which goes like this, very, very simple. Look here. Five or six big powers now dominate the world. And do not, it's not a question of dominating in the sense that now you can talk to two superpowers and several intermediate ones and so on. The world is actually carved up a few bits and bobs apart between a handful of big imperialist powers. Right? Therefore, the question, the national question, is now much more important than it was. Because you can, to use the analogy which he used, it is possible to fight the British capitalist in India as well as in Britain. Right? The whole notion of the support for national movements, not on sentimental grounds or anything like that, but because we want to disrupt the British Empire, the French Empire, etc., etc., etc. Hence the generalisation. his best, most detailed expression is in an article he wrote and then delivered as a speech at the Second Congress of the Communist International. And again, it's worth reading critically because he raises a number of questions which he doesn't answer, knowing he can't answer them, saying, you know, about the development of communist parties in certain circumstances and so on and so forth, if it is possible and so on and so forth. I don't want to go into the details of that. I want to point to the important shift in emphasis that has occurred. And that shift in emphasis is tied up to his change in the analysis of the world situation. Okay? We now come to, then, the generalisation today. The picture of the world which Lenin paints in Imperialism, which was written in 1916, does not fit the world today. Stop. Right? Does not. Which shouldn't surprise anyone, you know. The world changes. We're Marxists. The world changes all the time and so on and so forth. Of course, some essential features that he talks about in 1916 are present in the world today, but it is not the same world. Right? And therefore, we cannot mechanically take the Lenin argument of 1920 any more than we can take the Lenin argument of 1912-13, that was the argument with Luxembourg, and say, ah, yes, here's the text, Lenin said, and that's the answer. No, no, no. Notice in each case we started with Marx and Engels, going through the two stages of Lenin's development on the national question. His starting point always is the concrete circumstances, the effects of movement. Class character, yes, but their effects. Which leads us to today. And there are many complications. But we need to remember centrally two things. The first thing is, we are never nationalists. Always and invariably, we ourselves are internationalists. Support for a national movement, a specific national movement, let us say, for the unification of Ireland, does not make us Irish nationalists. On the contrary, the harder we do that, the harder we have to criticise reactionary utopian notions about, you know, a united Ireland, this, that and the other, and so on and so forth. We are never nationalists. Secondly, our perspective on the question depends on our attitude to our own big nation nationalism, the official ideology of British nationalism and so on and so forth. Which is why, to pursue this one for a bit, briefly, which is why, you know, we are all utterly contemptuous of two nation theories for Ireland, aren't we? Well, actually not. I mean, I had rather assumed we were. And yet, you know, if you want to go through a set of formal criteria, you know, the ones listed in Stalin's Marxism and the National Question, I can make a fair case. Actually, there is a separate nation. In terms of all the criteria listed, right? Language is not decisive, right? Nobody can doubt there is such a thing as an American nationality. They speak English, right? You know, and what have you. That is not disputed. The whole notion of a national idea, right, is something which is achieved in political struggle, and it is self-defining. If they regard themselves as a separate and distinct, etc., etc., then they are. Nevertheless, far from supporting Orange nationalism, far from supporting the whole notion that there are two nations and so on and so forth, we reject it out of hand. Why? Well, people might say, because they're a nasty lot. Well, that's true. Come on, that's not really decisive. No, no, because you ask yourself, what is in the interests of British imperialism? What is in our interest? That is basically why we have to say that although the political and economic notions of provisional Sinn Féin are petty bourgeois reactionary notions, no doubt whatsoever about that, nevertheless, we have to support the struggle, including the armed struggle, regardless of our criticism of tactics, against British imperialism. But not note dropping the criticisms, not note making any concessions at all to the basic notion that really things are political conflicts about national interest. It is not. Beneath the national label, there is always a class content. Okay? And their class content is not the same as ours. I want to just make two other points The first one I will let Lenin make for me, which may disarm some criticism because people are great literalists. In contrast to the petitions from Marxism and the national question, in contrast to the petty bourgeois Democrats, Marx regarded all democratic demands without exception, not as an absolute, but relative to specific circumstances. By democratic demands, he meant, this is the way the terminology was used, those demands which in principle, not necessarily in practice, but which in principle can be achieved under capitalism. One of them is, of course, the question of the national self-determination. And he goes on to say, there is not a single democratic demand which cannot serve and has not served under certain circumstances as an instrument of the bourgeoisie for deceiving the workers. That is preeminently true of nationalist movements, right? Preeminently true. Doesn't determine our attitude. What determines our attitude? Right? International working class perspective. Which brings me to the final point, which I'll make myself, although I could make Lenin say it too. It is this, and this is of very considerable practical importance. In the 1920 theses, when he's arguing, come on, the world has changed. I didn't notice at the time, but when I was writing against Luxembourg, the world's changed since then. The whole thesis about imperialism and so on. The mass of the world's population is in the oppressed nations and so on. Therefore, the national struggle is centrally important in terms of the overthrow of the world system, etc., etc., etc. All that's right. Therefore, it has to be supported. But, again, with the perspective of independent working class action. Supporting their action, but independent working class action. And in particular, under no circumstances whatsoever can Marxists accept the claim of the proto-nation or national group to dominate its own organisation. For the independent organisation of revolutionary working class organisation under all circumstances. Now, it is no accident that the ANC, for example, is extremely hostile to that notion. Of course it is. It is a national movement. It is a movement that we have to support, yes, support against the regime. It is also a movement which seeks to replace the existing ruling layer and become itself the exploiter of an African working class, yes? And therefore, under all circumstances, independence. Independence ideologically, that was the point I made a moment or two ago, independence politically. All right. Now, having said all that, there are, in my mind anyway, great big question marks. What about this? What about that? What about the other? And we have to say, come on, if the general argument that I have put forward is correct, you have to analyse the concrete circumstances in each case, which depends on facts. And with a correct method, you can come to a wrong conclusion if you've misread the facts. That's not tragic. It can be changed. But nevertheless, you cannot use a list of... You write down a shopping list. Does it meet criteria A, B, C, D? No, no, no. That is useful, perhaps, but in no way adequate. Attitude has got to be concrete in every case. Going back to the starting point, remember, all political struggles at the end of the day are class struggles. Right? And we have, therefore, to look at every movement from the point of view of A, what is its class content, doesn't in and of itself determine our attitude, or its conditions our attitude, and B, what is the effect of the success or failure of that movement on the working class movement internationally.